So you can look for a place where you are allowed to pray, and the place is allowable or mubah according to the legal terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you just said that the prayer mat is illegally obtained and mm-hmm. it's served. Of course, it doesn't make any difference whether you stand on the floor or on a carpet. If the carpet is you see is usurped, it is ghasbi, or it is illegally obtained, it's not permissible to offer your prayers on it. So a prayer will not be valid on an illegally obtained or purchased prayer mat. Anything, it could be a carpet, it could be a prayer mat, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you for that answer. And the next question would be about the jurisprudential status of, let's say a prayer mat where there are lots of holy names printed on it, like Allah's name or the Imam's name or the saint's name or whatever, and does that make your prayer, in fact, valid, or does it harm the prayer that you offer?
Well, it depends on where you stand. If you are going to stand on the name of Allah and on the names of the noble figures like the Holy Prophet, peace mm-hmm. be upon him,
yes.
It is absolutely forbidden, because it amounts to disrespect. It amounts to kind of disregard to Allah and also to the Holy Prophet and the Imams. So it's very much important to be careful not to stand on the names of those on holy names, mm-hmm. Generally speaking.
Yes.
Now we do know that there are some prayer mats with Allah's name or with the names of the Prophet and Imams drawn or printed on it. So we have to be very much careful not to stand on their names. But if we are to stand, if we stand on these names, of course, it does amount to disrespect, and it's not permissible. So if you stand according to Supreme Leader, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, your prayer is void. And this is a clear-cut fatwa. There is no precaution. It is the Ayatollah says that it is haram to stand on Allah's name, because it is disrespectful.
Yes.
And so your prayer is definitely affected.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is the case with the names of the Prophet and Imams.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't worry. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker at the studio. We are talking about the rules about prayer according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Just before the break, I asked you a question regarding the Islamic law about standing on a prayer mat on which some of the holy figures' names have been printed, such as Allah's name or the Prophet's name or the Imam's. But what about the muhr, the piece of, in fact, soil that, she is usually carry with them, because it is clean, and then they offer the prayer by having their forehead, in fact, laid on it, and then they offer the prayer usually in prostration on that muhr. And it happens to be like some of the, again, names printed on it. Does it have the same jurisprudential status as the prayer mat, or it's something different?
Yeah, it is different, because the name embossed on the turba, or ingrained in on the stone or the turba, you are not going to stand on the turba. You are going to place your forehead on the turba,
mm-hmm.
and of course you are not going to put your head on that surface or on that side of the turba which bears the God's name or the names of the Prophet Even though it's not forbidden, it is still permissible to do sajda on that.
Is that even reprehensible?
It's not reprehensible either, you know. It's still permissible, but it is, you know, better according to the religious authorities to do sajda on the smooth surface of the turba.
So why do they in fact print such things on the mohr?
You know, the reason is unclear. No one suggests or says that you have to do it in adding God's name or that of the names of the Prophet and Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
I see.
Does not, has not been recommended to be added to the turba.
Yes, of course. This is one of the wrong cultures, probably.
Yeah. Nowhere are you able to find any text or any riwayah which would suggest you or call you to do this.
I see.
But people, you know, out of their own, you know, like and dislike or mood,
I see,
choose to add these names.
Okay. How about the Islamic law about praying or offering your prayer in front of the Imam's shrines or the shrine of the Holy Prophet?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that it is not permissible to offer your prayers with the grave of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, or the grave of an imam behind you. This is the fatwa you can find in his book, the Manual of Islamic Laws. So if it is in front of you or you are standing by there, at the side of the grave, there is no objection. But if you pray with the Holy Prophet's grave behind you, immediately, with no barrier, no wall, no chamber, and the grave is behind you, so it's not permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Of course, the prayer is void, because it's a kind of disrespect. Yeah, it amounts to disrespect. So you have to be careful not to stand with your back behind, with your back towards the grave of the Holy Prophet.
What if somebody makes a barrier?
If there is a barrier, like for example, a curtain is there or a wall is there, which prevents seeing.
I've seen some people putting a chair, for example, behind them as a kind of barrier. Does that make a barrier?
Yeah, you have to look at the. This is a matter of common sense, you know. You should see whether in common view, it's still considered disrespect or disrespectful or not.
Right.
You know, if in the in common view, if in the eye of custom, it is still considered to be disrespectful, of course, it's not permissible.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your contribution to the program Islamic Laws with me and the rest of the crew here on the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio. We say Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Keep us in your du'as and prayers.
Imam Baqir, Repository of Celestial Knowledge. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest congratulations to you on a very special occasion. Today is the first of Rajab, the month when God Almighty showers his blessings on the seekers of truth. the seekers of forgiveness, the penitents, the worshippers, and all those who strive in his path. This year, Rajab has started on Thursday, which means that tonight, the first Friday eve of this blessed month, is Laylatul Raghaib, or the night of desirability. The word desirability here means the display of the innate desires of dedicated and pious Muslims for attaining the proximity of the Lord Most High. And this is possible only through acts of virtue. For this auspicious night, a special observance has been narrated from the Prophet. And among the virtues of this 12 rak'at prayer to be performed immediately after the Maghrib or evening prayer is expiation of many sins and unimaginable rewards. The first day of Rajab also happens to be the auspicious birth anniversary of a very special person. He was none other than the namesake of the Prophet of Islam, and in fact, the fifth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Stay with us for a special feature on the life and times of Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, who was descended on both sides, that is, father and mother, from the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind. If I found worthy carriers for my knowledge, which Allah, the Great and Almighty, has given to me, I would proclaim monotheism, Islam, religion, and Islamic laws. How can I do that? My great-grandfather, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, found no worthy carriers for his knowledge. Thus, he sighed deeply on the pulpit and said, "Question me before you lose me, for there is much knowledge among these ribs." What you heard is the statement recorded in Volume 2 of the book Safinatul Bihar from the namesake and 15th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He was prophesied by the seal of messengers as Baqirul Ulum, or the splitter and spreader of sciences. Born in the Prophet's city, Medina, 57 years after the Prophet's migration from Mecca to Medina, and 46 years after the passing away of the Prophet from the mortal world, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was knowledge personified. His father, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, was the son of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, while his mother, Fatimah, peace upon her, was the daughter of the Prophet's elder grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. He was inheritor of the celestial knowledge bequeathed by the Prophet on the commandment of God to his great-grandfather, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. It was divine providence he was born on the first of Rajab, which is one of the four sacred months of the Islamic calendar. It is the month in which the All-Merciful, in addition to the regular conduits of mercy, opens up special passageways to his creatures for attaining greater heights of virtue. Indeed, fortunate are those who grab this opportunity to strive towards the bounties of the hereafter. Last night, on the eve of Rajab, most of the faithful may have performed the special prayers and recited the exclusive supplications in the divine court. Today, many are fasting and are observing the special prayers of the first of Rajab and will follow up tonight with exclusive prayers of Laylatul Raghaib, or the night of desirability. The faithful are humbly requesting God to firm up their faith, enlighten their minds, illuminate their hearts, purify their souls, strengthen their spirits, and make them worthy recipients of the bezels of knowledge specified by the 50 Imam. They are also praying to the Lord Most High to alleviate the sufferings of all believers, especially the defenseless people of Yemen, who are the victims of the criminal invasion and aerial bombardment of the past 7 years of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which are backed by the US, Britain, and the illegal Zionist entity. God's promise is true. He will surely make the true believers triumphant, no matter what atrocities the hypocrites and the faithless commit, since He has preserved for the salvation of humanity the Prophet of Islam's 12th and last infallible heir, who will reappear in the end times as Imam Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his advent to rid planet Earth of all oppression through establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Amen. For his part, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, who, as a four-year-old, was present in Karbala on the day of Ashura, or 10th of Muharram, 61 AH, when history's most heartrending occurred, and who, in its equally tragic aftermath, despite his tender age, suffered imprisonment in Damascus, along with his parents, aunts and grand-aunts, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her, and Umm Kulthum, peace upon her, has said, "The master of the affair was named as Mahdi because he will unearth the original Torah and other heavenly scripture from the cave in Antioch. He will judge among the people of the Torah according to the Torah, among the people of the Evangel according to the Evangel, among the people of Psalms in accordance with the Psalms, and among the people of the Qur'an, in accordance with the Qur'an." These words from the Imam, on whose authority scholars wrote accounts of the prophets of the past, the Sunnah, Wasira, or behavior and practice of the Prophet of Islam, the exegesis of the ayahs of the Noble Qur'an, and the jurisprudential principles of the Sharia, provide solace to the hearts of not just Shia Muslims, but also our Sunni brethren, whose books of hadith are riplet with countless narrations from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him. As a matter of fact, all monotheists take comfort from the words of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, who, as the righteous heirs of the Prophet of Islam, preached peace, friendship, and fraternity, unlike the usurper Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs, who, like the satanic Takfiri terrorists of our own days, divided Muslims into sects, massacred people, terrorized countries, destroyed the heritage of the nations of the past, and looted the masses to fill up their coffers. Those in doubt are invited to study the fruitful life of the fifth infallible Imam, who during his 19-year mission resisted against five tyrannical Umayyad caliphs, whose empire that stretched from Spain in the west to Pakistan in the east has long evaporated, in order to pass on to posterity the ethereal values of universal brotherhood. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, groomed leading lights of Islam who could be called immortals. Names that come to mind are Zurar bin Ayan, the master theologian, Muhammad bin Muslim bin Raya, the eminent jurist, Fudail ibn Yasar, the exegete, Ma'ruf ibn Karub, the hadith compiler, Buraid al-Jili, the rhetorician, and Abu Basir Layth al-Bakhtari, the famous traditionist. These six are mentioned in the list of the 10 pegs of the world. Then there was Abu Hamza Somali, who held an esteemed place among the companions of both the fourth and fifth Imams, and through whose some moving supplications have been conveyed to posterity, including the famous one taught by Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace upon him, and recited till this day by the faithful before Sahar or late midnight in the fasting month of Ramadan. Among the fifth Imam's companions was also the renowned poet and master of Arabic literature, Kumayt ibn Zayd al-Asadi, whose panegyrics titled Al-Hashemiyat are still recited to this day. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, who, despite his grooming of scholars, would at times love to toil under the blazing sun of Arabia by personally engaging in farming in order to set the practical example of dignified labor for earning of legal and lawful subsistence bread, has said the following: "There is no job better than farming, and there is no benefit better than the benefit of farming, because both benevolent and malevolent grazing animals and birds benefit from it and pray for the farmer." He also encouraged people to marry, raise children, and cater to their needs in lawful and legal manner, but at the same time fulfill their duties towards Allah, the All-Merciful Creator. Here is one of the famous sayings of the fifth Imam on the authority of his ancestor, the Prophet: "Islam is a firm and decisive faith. Scale its heights, but calmly. Don't put excessive weight of prayer on your bodies. Don't be like a rider who tires his animal by traveling more than it possibly can. It may fail to carry you to your destination. Satan has misguided some of our people and made them abstain from meat and other delicacies. Such abstention is against the Sharia." In conclusion, in view of the significance of this month, we refer to a very famous hadith, which says that anyone who recites in Rajab Astaghfirullah wa atubu ilayh 70 times in the morning and 70 times in the evening, and thereafter raising his hands, says Allahumma aghfir li wa atubu ilayh, should she or he die during Rajab, God shall be pleased with him or her, and hellfire shall not touch him or her.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bafizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, bahre ehyay haq jan fada, Kas batre, یه خون پاک شما می روید تا ابد در وطن ناله ها بدفیزی 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 بدفیزی
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomeini on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile. This time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iran. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia, or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime. Ultimately, on the 16th of January, 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Nofel Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as the revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least 7 coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa.
Well, I think the U.S. is very much afraid of Africa becoming, the countries of Africa working together and becoming a powerhouse that would be able to rival the United States and rival Western Europe. Because you have to think about it, Africa is a very, very big continent, which much bigger than the United States, with a lot more valuable resources in this modern age. So I think the United States is afraid.
The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against Al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, Al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for the civilians killed in its airstrikes. The United States has failed to provide an accurate tally of equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen to the wrong hands.
Oh, the United States, by picking up this banner that the United Kingdom, the British Empire left, has basically realized the most effective way to combat any sort of rise of anti-imperialism or any sort of self-determination for these colonized, these exploited countries, is by, instead of just launching a full-out invasion of U.S. forces, that the intelligence agencies should begin covertly funding and fostering organizations that will have inner conflict between the main group, in the case of Mau Mau, by supporting a counter game.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa is the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
In January 2017, a Canadian man fatally shot six worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center and seriously injured 19 others. Over the past 5 years, Muslim community members have pushed decision-makers at all levels to denounce Islamophobia and put concrete measures in place to curb incitement and hate-filled violence, including through stricter gun control laws. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who immediately called the killings a terrorist attack on Muslims, has since faced criticism and calls to do more to stem Islamophobia. Those demands grew louder in the aftermath of a string of hate-filled incidents, including an attack that left four members of a Muslim family dead in London, Ontario, last June. Also, in another hate crime incident, Canada's deadliest vehicle ramming attack happened in 2018, when a man plowed his van into a group of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 people. On Friday, the federal government announced in a statement that it intends to appoint a special representative to combat Islamophobia in Canada. But how effective would that be? Muslim Canadians are facing a sharp increase in violent hate crimes in public places and in places of work and worship. One example is the murder of Muhammad Aslim Zafis, who was killed outside a Toronto mosque in September 2020. Most recently, black Muslim women have also been disproportionately targeted by Islamophobic street harassment and assaults, particularly in Alberta. A report says in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Also, over the past decade, police-reported hate crimes against Muslims in Canada have risen from 45 in 2012 to 181 in 2018. Now, on the fifth anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting and the National Day of Action Against Islamophobia on January 29th, around a dozen Canadian Muslims are speaking out about experiences of Islamophobia in a new report from the charity Islamic Relief Canada. According to the report, many of those who've shared their experiences felt they were to be expected, living as a minority in Canada. The report also found that more women tended to be the targets of Islamophobia. A report by the National Council of Canadian Muslims stated that Muslims living in Canada have been increasingly facing anti-Muslim sentiments since the 9/11 attacks happened 2 decades ago in the U.S. The advocacy organization said Islamophobia is systemic in Canada and is evolving. The hate increased in the years immediately following the World Trade Center attack and has slowly grown since, with Statistics Canada reporting that anti-Muslim attacks numbered 99 in 2014, up from 36 in 2009. In 2015, hate crimes ballooned to 159, a 60% jump, and in 2017, incidents showed a dramatic increase to 349. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday said that Islamophobia is not acceptable at any cost and vowed to make his country safer for Muslims. But how successful has Trudeau been as a leader to address systemic Islamophobia as a major priority in Canada? Human rights advocates have criticized Trudeau's government for failing to meet its promise to deliver legislation to address hate crimes against minorities.
Now, the point is this, that this actually is not just as a result of 9/11. The level of Islamophobia around the world was actually very high even before 9/11.
Justin Trudeau had said while he is deeply opposed to Bill 21, which bars a range of public servants in roles of authority, including teachers, from wearing visible religious symbols, his government won't step into the legal challenge taking place in Quebec to avoid triggering a fight with the province over jurisdiction. In December 2021, an elementary school teacher in Quebec was told she could no longer teach in class because she wears a hijab, which is prohibited under Bill 21. That marks another failure for Trudeau as he falls short of condemning the bigotry against Muslims wearing symbols of their faith in his home province. Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images showed the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdul Rahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932, exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, Ardistic News. With delight.
It's a joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep a social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new lunar year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991. Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
Many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. As surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year, 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fears surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately a million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 1st. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
National Zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porcupet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PAMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zara is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zara says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zara had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zara says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be?
www.parstoday.com/en.